This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all Have Another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, HRRN Nation. Welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna with you once again in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, extending a special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM Channel 206, and those of you tuning in on our website, on your smartphone or your tablet with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. You know, ever since we launched this show in September of 2012, I've been asked one particular question countless times. When are you going to do a Trainer Talk with Jude Feld? And as most of you know, Jude and I have worked together for nearly a decade now on HRN. He was with me for the very first Trainer Talk show with our special guest Ron Ellis 2.5 years ago. And you can still hear him with me, of course, on various shows and on race coverage that we bring you throughout the year. We're together so much that people often refer to us as life partners and have even said that we have the best bromance in racing. Tough to argue with either of those. Well, tonight, the wait is over, and I welcome in the pontiff of the pick four himself, Jude Feld. He is with me on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton because, oh, by the way, he enjoyed a very successful 20-year training career before pursuing other interests, and we're going to tell you all about it over the course of the next hour here tonight. JT, welcome to the show, my friend.
Yeah, it's quite an honor to be on Trainer Talk. Never thought it would happen.
Well, you're always the one doing the interviews with me. You've never been on this side of the fence. How's it feel?
Interesting. I'm excited to talk about it. I feel like a lot of other guys that have been on the show, I don't know if I can talk about myself that long.
Well, we'll try to keep it going for the course of the next hour. And, of course, do welcome everybody throughout North America and worldwide joining us here on the show tonight. If you miss any portion of this interview, you can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast that's also available on Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes as well. JT, you know, as I was getting ready for the show, I was just thinking back on so many of the top moments that you and I have been together on radio for. And one thing that really struck me is that last year you stepped away from the radio side of things to work with some friends in the restaurant business where you now live in New Jersey. And another question that I got quite often was, how is Jude? And every track I would go to, people would say, how is Jude? Do you think he'll come back on radio? And one thing that I notice is that even from the very beginning with Jude Feld, you love this sport. You love the horses, and it's nearly impossible to keep you away from being around the horses, being around this sport. Is that true?
Yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, I started going to the races when I was 3 years old at Santa Anita, and it's been a big part of my life ever since. My dad and my uncle, Neil Barton, they took me to the track many, many times when I was very young. And so, you know, it's been a family tradition for a long, long time. My brother, my nephew, my brother Mark, they're all in the business. And, you know, we love horse racing, and we love the sport. And so it's just a natural for us, really.
What do you remember about those early days of going to the track with your dad?
Well, you know, I mean, going to the Santa Anita Handicap was always a thrill for my brothers and I, and that was always great. But a lot of times, you know, we'd just go to the last race. You'd get in free, and we'd pick up a program off the ground in a racing form out of the trash can and do a little handicapping. The first book report I ever did was on a book called Making Money on the Races, which I still have. And I was in the third grade, and Sister Annette was my teacher at St. Luke's School, and she called my mom and said she didn't think it was suitable material for a third grade boy. But my mom, who was Catholic educated all the way through college, stuck up for me. First time she ever spoke back to a nun, I'm sure. And, you know, she said she thought it was better than the girly magazines some of my friends were finding under their brother's bed. So that kind of shut up Sister Annette. And then when we got to fractions, and I knew so much about fractions, she asked me how I knew so much about fractions. And I went up and I drew a racetrack on the board and put all the poles in and explained it. So she kind of changed her tune about horse racing after that and saw that it could actually be an intellectual pursuit.
So your parents were always okay with you and your brothers being involved or at least interested in the sport at that point?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, my mom didn't really like horse racing all that much. It wasn't until I became a trainer that she actually, you know, oh, that's my son has horses at Santa Anita, that kind of thing. You know, she got into it then, but she wasn't really into sports at all of any kind. But my dad had owned a horse before I was born, and my uncle was, you know, in love with the game, so it was just a family thing. It was a thing that we did with my father, he didn't have a lot of hobbies, but horse racing was his number one, and it was a good way to spend an afternoon out. We'd go to the races and have some fun and learn about horses and life, and yeah, it was great.
I always tell the story of cashing my first ticket when I went to Saratoga, and I was hooked after winning a $2 across the board bet on Easy Goer in the Traverse Stakes, and I don't know, maybe I got back $1.60 in profit, if that. How about you? Do you remember the first ticket that you ever cashed at the racetrack on your own?
I do. My father wouldn't let me bet until I was 11, and his aunt every year would send me $2 in a birthday card. So I got my $2 for my 11th birthday, and that Saturday we went to the track, and I bet on a horse named Candy Cane, as I recall, and the horse won, and that was a big thrill for me. But I had been handicapping before I was 11 years old. I mean, obviously, you know, I'd get the form and stuff, but he would never let us make a bet until we turned 11. I don't know where he got that number, but he was a man of numbers. So that was kind of the way he planned it, and that's what we did.
Did you have a favorite horse when you were a kid growing up around it?
Well, I don't know. I'm so old now I lost track of time, really, but my favorite horse when I was younger was Cougar II. Mary Jones Bradley owned the horse, and Charlie Whittingham trained, and Shoemaker rode him. He was a magnificent horse. Joe Hernandez, the old track announcer at Santa Anita, had purchased him, and he was just a really good horse. And one thing I really liked about Cougar was he'd come out on the track for the races, and he'd walk down about a 16th of a mile, and then he'd like turn around and look at the grandstand and people would applaud. And then he'd walk another 16th of a mile and he'd turn around again and people would applaud him again. It was just really cool. He had a lot of personality. He was a hell of a racehorse.
Yeah, he was an outstanding racehorse. How about any idols? Did you look up to any other trainers? Or I know you didn't want to be a jockey at that point, but were there any any idols?
Yeah, I think
that
when I was in kindergarten, I was already having to hit the
You towered over Shoemaker already.
Yeah, well, I was so lucky to be a trainer during the last part of the golden age of racing. I mean, Charlie Whittingham was always, you know, an idol of mine, and my brother Bob. When we were growing up, we used to cut out past performance charts and with the workout, so we knew how Charlie trained a horse for a particular race, just mainly for our interest and what we were hoping to be able to do later on in life, and that's, you know, work on the racetrack, which, you know, we learned a lot from that. And then my personal idol, Bobby Frankel, you know, I learned a lot from Bobby and loved being around him. Just a really interesting guy to be around and a natural horseman. I mean, really, really, for somebody that, you know, was brought up in New York and didn't really, New York City, Brooklyn, didn't really have, you know, a bunch of horses around other than, you know, police horses or whatever. That was kind of similar to me growing up in L.A. The only time I ever got to see horses was when I went to the track, and I always loved horses. So, you know, Bobby was my biggest idol. And then I, you know, I had other guys too that were great mentors to me. Laz Barrera was just unbelievable to me, did some very kind things for me over the years. So, you know, there's a lot of guys you look up to. One thing I will say is back in those days, if you ever had a problem with a horse, you could go to Charlie Whittingham and ask him. You could go to Bobby Frankel and ask him. You could go to Buster Milrick or Laz Barrera and ask them, and they would help you. And it wasn't nearly as cutthroat as it is now.
Yeah, every trainer that's ever come on this program, JT, even going back to when you were hosting these shows with me a couple of years ago, when they talk about Bobby Frankel, they talk about Bobby Frankel, the teacher, and what they learned from him. What did you learn from Bobby that helped you when you were training?
Just observation more than anything. I mean, he was so good at looking at a horse and seeing if there was a problem. You know, he would see it like from a block away. I remember the first horse that I had, my brother Bob and I bought a filly that we named Fanciness at a 2-year-old sale in at Hollywood Park. And I was training the horse. I was working for Julio Canani at the time, and I was training the horse, and we were stabled in Bobby's barn. And, you know, the filly had like a little vein that ran around her tendon. And we were going to the track one day, and she was a real pretty filly. And Bobby called me over, and he said, did you look at that filly this morning? And I go, yeah. He says, it looks like she might have a little issue with her tendon. And I said, it's a vein that runs over the tendon. I said, do you want to look at it? And he goes, no, that's okay. As long as you know it's there, that's all right. He said, but I just didn't want anything bad to happen to her, you know. Wow. And that's the kind of guy he was, you know. And if ever I had a problem with a horse, you know, I would take the horse over to Bobby's barn and jog it up and down the shed row for him. And, you know, he would say, oh, you know, I think he's got a little problem behind or this or that. Or he said, why don't you have Dr. Arthur look at him? And Rick Arthur would take a look at him. And, you know, I mean, just a natural born horseman. I mean, the guy was a freak. And an unbelievably talented trainer, and really had an affinity for the animals. I mean, everybody knows how much he loved his dogs, and he loved his horses just as much. Amazing animal person, really.
Visiting with the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld, you asked for it, you got it, right here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. JT, you began your career in racing right around 1978. You started making charts for the Daily Racing Form. That was at Ellis Park. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But before you got to that point, did you ever consider going in a different direction and doing something completely different that didn't involve horse racing?
Yeah, I was going to be a priest.
Thus the Pontiff of the Pick Four.
That's right. Yeah, I really wanted to be a priest. There were a bunch of us that went to school together, and there were five of us actually that were going to go to the seminary, and four of us went. I was the lone defector, and I would have gone, but my mother and Sister Indiolata, the principal of St. Luke's School where I went to grammar school, they conspired against me and said I had to go out with girls before I went to the seminary. So I had to go to regular high school. And then if I wanted to go to the seminary, I could. But as luck would have it, I fell in love and decided to become a horse trainer.
Did you ever regret not becoming a priest or no?
Yeah, once in a while.
Yeah?
I think sometimes life would be a lot easier. but, you know, I feel like I kind of did a little bit of priestly work on the backside. You know, I had a lot of people that came into my life and my barn that needed help in various ways, and I was able to help them or give them a boost or, you know, explain life to them a little bit. And so I think, you know, that was a good thing. And you know, I'm never really super regretted it, but you know how you think sometimes, oh, what if I had done this? You know, it's like your life changes so quickly on the most minuscule thing, and you never know what's going to happen. But I'm quite happy with my life, really.
So what eventually led to the decision to get involved working with the Racing Form and making those charts at Ellis Park?
Well, I had struck up a friendship with Alan Buchdahl, who was the race caller at Santa Anita for a while, and Alan and I were the same age, and Alan got offered the job to call the race at River Downs after Santa Anita was over from Jack Hoover, who was a big breeder in California and owned part of River Downs. And so Alan took the job, but he'd never been away from home, and he'd always lived with his mom. His father had passed away when he was very young, and so he really didn't want to go by himself. And I was graduating from college, and he said, you know, you've always wanted to get into racing, you know, do you want to come with me? And then, you know, maybe you can get a job at a, you know, smaller track like River Downs. They're probably more anxious to hire people that don't have a lot of experience in this and that. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. And so I sold everything. I sold my car and I moved to Ohio with Alan. And he had a condo that the racetrack had gotten him on a golf course, which was nice, and a little bass lake outside the back door. And I was in my glory. And as luck would have it, they needed somebody to make the charts at Ellis Park. And by then, Alan had established himself and was dating a girl, and everything was all, you know, hunky-dory for him, and he felt comfortable there. So I asked him, I said, do you mind if I take this job? And he said, no, that's great. You know, that's what you came here for. So he went to the car dealer that had leased him his car and told him to lease me one. And they did on the spot. Wow. It was like surreal. And I drove this little orange car to Evansville, Indiana, where I had never been before and didn't know a soul. And I got my first job with the Racing Form there, and it was fantastic.
Did it take-
and I had the best summer of my life in 1978. I mean, it was so fantastic. I met Cliff Gilliams, the late Cliff Gilliams, who was just a fantastic guy. I worked with Jack Valentine, who makes the charts of the races at Keeneland and Churchill and other tracks. And, you know, I mean, Jerry Fork was the teletype operator there, one of the kindest men I've ever met. I just had a great, great summer. And it was really a tremendous highlight for me.
You've told me several times that it was just one big family there at Ellis Park, especially with some of the names that you just mentioned.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we had a softball league that was a lot of fun, and everybody got along good and worked together. And, you know, the racing wasn't the greatest. I mean, there were like four or five different levels of $2,500 claimers, non-winners of 1, 2, 3, 4 of the year, you know, but it was a great experience. Plus, I had the time to make a lot of notes and handicap. There wasn't a lot of information in the form like there is nowadays, so the class levels were different. A $2,500 claimer just showed in the form $2,500 claimer. It didn't say 1, 2, 3, or 4. So I knew where the levels were. I knew where the trainers were manipulating horses in the different levels. I was making more money gambling every week than I was getting paid from the form, and the form paid very generously in those days. And so I had absolutely no complaints. We were eating steak and lobster every night, and I probably gained about 50 pounds that summer because even though it was hot and sweaty in the press box, we went out and ate and drank like kings every night.
As I mentioned, that was 1978. Two years later, you're training horses. What happened in those 2 years from 78 to 80 that led you to take out your trainer's license in 1980?
Well, when I was in the softball league, I met a guy named Doug Udach. He was my age and a really cool guy, and we hit it off. And his family was the leading breeders in Arkansas, and he had some horses for his dad, Carl, who was a dentist, and his uncle. And so, you know, I started working for Doug, and I, you know, walked hots in the morning and, you know, kind of started running the shed row a little bit. And by the end of the summer, I was kind of like his quasi-assistant. You know, I was trying to help him out as much as I could. And I'd do that in the morning. I'd get to the barn like at 4:30, and then at 8 o'clock I started for the racing form. So I'd go from the barn over to the front side to the racing office and type up my charts and do all the things that I needed to do for the form. And then after the races were over, a lot of times go back to the barn and, you know, see what was going on and whatever. So I really got into being around the horses and, you know, kind of semi-training. We had this one little filly named Galindi that, like, she was about 700 pounds, one of the smallest horses I'd ever seen. And she was kind of a rat and not easy to deal with. And Doug kind of got disgusted with her. And one day he said to me, "You train her. I can't deal with her." Doug was like that. He was a little volatile sometimes. So I took her on, and I had every ticket in the daily double pool. She ran second. The first time I ran, she ran second.
Wow.
Got beat just a short ways. And, oh, man, was I depressed. I was gonna have a barn full of horses. I was going to take all that money and buy a bunch of horses at Ellis Park. Boy, talk about a life-changing experience. How many $2,500 claimers can you buy with the whole daily double pool? So, that was like a great thrill for me. And I just kind of started to really get an affinity for the animals, you know, not having been raised around horses or whatever. It was a little different. And when we got to Turfway, there was a big old meadow out in the back, and we had this filly, her name was Country Home. I don't even know how I'm remembering this stuff, but she had sore knees and she was just like the biggest sweetheart. And I would take her out in that field and graze her. She was going to be retired for a broodmare, but I would just take her out there and I'd spend, you know, 2 hours out in the meadow with this horse, just like, you know, petting her, talking to her. And I mean, it was just a great experience just to, you know, learn about horses, how they think, how they act, what, you know, turns them on. And I mean, it was a lot of fun. So I was just like a sponge soaking up all this great new stuff, you know?
Now, when you started training, though, you were in California. So what brought you back to California from Ellis Park and Kentucky?
Well, the racing form was very generous as far as their pay was concerned, but they were very cheap with travel expenses. And I was supposed to go to Oaklawn to work with Jack Valentine again, but I had gone home to visit my parents. My dad called me and said that my mom really missed me and could I come home for a bit. So I said, yeah, I can come home for a little while. And so I went home, and while I was in California, the guy that was making the charts of the races in California, Ron Wasserman, he decided to become a jockey agent for Chuck Balthazar. So he quit working for the form, and they needed somebody there. So I had one meeting at Ellis Park, and now I'm going to one of the best racetracks in the country to work with legendary track man Jay Woodward. And so they summoned me to the daily racing form office in L.A., and I met with Mickey Samber, who was the president of the form, and he, like, threatened me with my life. He said, "No, I'm going to give you this job because Jack says you can handle it, Jack Valentine." And he said, "But if you screw up once, you're out of there." So nobody had ever really talked to me like that before. And so I went about my business at Santa Anita, and I did a really good job, and I hit it off with Jay. Jay was about to retire, and on his last day at Santa Anita, he really got verklempt and said, you know, he would have never retired if he would have known that he was going to work with me, because we had so much fun during the meet. And we did. We had a great time. We laughed and joked and had a fantastic time. And I was very fortunate to be there, too, because I got to know Mr. Kilrow, Jimmy Kilrow, very, very well, and got to sit in his office and talk racing, and met Tommy Robbins there. Tommy was assistant racing secretary, and some unbelievable guys worked in the racing office then. George Taniguchi and the stewards were great. And it was just a fantastic experience for me to be part of California racing where I grew up. And again, just very, very fortunate. I was there, I met Julio Canani, who was doing the race results on the radio in Spanish. And Julio said, you know, he found out that I had worked with the horses and said, why don't you come out to my barn and, you know, you can hang out and give me a hand. He only had a few horses. And so I did. I went out one morning and said, it's freezing here. He said, he handed me a horse. He said, here, walk this horse. It'll warm you up. Julio never wanted to pass up on free help. So I started working for Julio, and through Julio, I met Bobby Frankel, and, you know, the rest, as they say, is history.
Well, it is history, and to be around guys like Julio Canani and Bobby Frankel and to learn from them had to be just an amazing experience for you, especially at that age. I mean, you're a young man. You're just getting started. How about Julio? You talked about Bobby and how he taught people to really respect the horse. How about Julio? What was his approach?
Well, Julio is a great horseman and a very knowledgeable guy. He was really good at spotting horses. He was really terrific with getting horses ready for a particular race. Very good with legs. I mean, those were things that were important in Julio's life, because he usually had sheep horses, claiming horses. You know, and in those days, Bobby was a claiming trainer too. I mean, you know, Bobby had a lot of claiming horses, and what I used to do was go with Bobby's assistant every day, Julio or Umberto Ascanio, and Umberto was the one that taught me the most about taking care of a horse's legs. And Bobby would have 40, 45 head of horses at the barn at Hollywood Park, and Umberto would go with me every horse in every stall and say, okay, this horse has a bad knee. This is what we're going to do. This horse has an ankle. We're going to do this. This horse is perfectly sound. This horse grabbed his quarter. We're going to fix this. You know, and I did that every day. It was like the best college you could have for a horse trainer. I mean, to see all those horses and see the absolute finest care that they received for their problems every day for a year, it was awesome. I mean, it was just freakishly great. And so for that, I'm ever thankful to Umberto Ascanio for teaching me how to really take care of a horse.
Visiting with the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld, here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. We're going to step away for a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the memorable moments and memorable horses that Jude had the chance to be around in his 20-year training career. We'll tell you about some of the celebrities he had the chance to train for as well. That's ahead in part two. Stay with us. Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.
The Fasig Tipton Yearling Sales, your roadmap to success. In 2014, the Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sale, July Sale, and New York Bred Sale were ranked the top three sales in North America by rate of return. And the July Sale was once again a top-ranked sale by percentage of graded stakes-winning graduates, with an average of more than $94,000, including undefeated leading Kentucky Derby contender, Dortmund.
Dortmund is all heart. He shifted his ground a little, but he's clear. And Dortmund, another stylish performance. Dortmund wins.
The Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sale is annually the number one ranked North American yearling sale by percentage of grade one winners. In 2014, the Saratoga Sale boasted a $291,000 average and a median of more than $237,000, with past graduates including grade one Don Handicap winner Constitution and the brilliant juvenile champion American Pharoah.
American Pharoah will romp home in the Rebel.
It's never too late to nominate, so make plans now to sell your yearlings at the leading sales in North America. Visit FasigTipton.com to nominate today.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
Jude Feld, the pontiff of the Pick 4. You hear him on HRRN Radio. Now get his personal selections directly from him at his new site, PopeJude.com. Every analysis sheet at PopeJude.com has his personal selections and insights. Each page is a handicapping lesson packed with years of racing knowledge, coupled with insider information gleaned from the pontiff's countless connections in thoroughbred racing. Whether you're looking for another set of eyes on the past performances or inspired racing analysis to assault the windows, PopeJude.com is the site for you.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
HRRN's newest show is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Every Tuesday, Mike Penna and Christina McManigal will bring you exclusive interviews with the best jockeys in the business. Tune in on our website for a new episode every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, exclusively on horseracingradio.net.
This is Eddie Delahoussaye. You're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton on HRRN. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in our Lexington studios visiting with the pontiff of the Pick 4, Jude Feld. If you're just joining us, well, first of all, shame on you for missing this first half of the program here tonight. It's been a really fun interview, and hearing some things that even I didn't know after being around Jude Feld for a full decade. And if you missed any portion, you can go to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out a podcast. It will be available shortly after we go off the air here this evening. And of course, you can always check it out on iTunes, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Put it in your phone. It'll come right to your phone each and every time we have a new show. And looking forward to the second half of the program. JT, we left off talking about your introduction to training and being around guys like Julio Canani. You touched on Bobby Frankel as well as in the first half of the program. You trained 223 winners in your 20-year career. 23 of those were stakes winners, including some really nice graded stakes winners. Talk to me about some of the horses that really stand out to you.
Well, you know, the first graded stakes winner I had was a horse named Pewter Gray that my brother Bob had seen race. For some reason, I wasn't at the track that day, and Bob came home. We were living together in an apartment in Arcadia, and he came home and he said, "You gotta watch the replay tonight and watch this horse, because Don Pierce never let this horse run, and I think he can really be a nice horse." So I watched the race with Bob that night, and it was true. They gave him the race, and so we were on him, and I had some doctors that wanted to claim a horse, and the partnership was headed by a guy named Frank DiFiore, and he wanted to claim a horse for $20,000-$25,000, and they deposited the money and made me authorized agent. Well, they came up with this horse that Daryl Vienna had, and I can't remember the horse's name, but they wanted to claim him, and I didn't like the way that the horse walked over. I just didn't think he was the right horse for them. So I passed on the horse. He won by 11.
Of course.
And they were very, very upset with me. But needless to say, that horse never really panned out after that. In the meantime, I tell him about this horse that Bob had found and that I thought was really, really nice. And I had seen him in the mornings a couple times, and he was a really good-looking horse. He was by Grey Dawn out of a Hawaii mare, very well-bred. He's from the family of Mississippi Mud, which is Ambassador Farish's wife's father, Baird Sharp's family, a very, very good family of horses. So anyway, we claim this horse. He gets beat 100 miles the day we claim him, and just they're really upset because they wanted this horse to 1x11. Now I claim him a horse that runs like crap. So, you know, my name was Mud. So the first time Bob and I worked this horse, we feel like he's maybe being a little lazy. He's not putting out. We put blinkers on him. He worked 58-2.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what we said. Wow, that's eye-popping. Right? So now I don't want to lose him, so I run him into the lounge race, and he shows a little speed and backs up, but he kind of runs like a bum. And I don't know this, but they're really thinking about firing me now. You know, they're very upset with me. So one day I'm taking a leak, and above my toilet I had a picture of Vigors winning the Sandina Handicap. And Vigors was by Grey Dawn II. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, this horse always goes to the lead. What he needs to do is be taken back and make one run. So it pays to go to the bathroom once in a while. And
you never know where you're going to find inspiration.
That's right. I put Fernando Toro on him. I put him in for 32,000 claiming. We had claimed him for 20,000. Put him in for 32, figuring nobody's going to claim him off of his dismal form since I started training him. And Fernando comes to the paddock, and I said, listen, I want you to grab a hold of this horse coming out of the gate, take him back to dead last, and do not let him run till the quarter pole. And I said, if you're not last going into the first turn, don't bother coming back because I'm going to belt you one. Fernando looked at me because I usually didn't talk like that, but I was adamant I wanted this horse anchored early and then let run. So Fernando rode him perfectly. And Terry Lipham was on like a dying quail at the top of the lane, and Fernando yelled at him, and Terry moved over a little bit and let Fernando through. And this horse won for fun, and he paid $91.60.
Wow.
And then I never ran him for a tag after that. He went up the ladder. He won lounge races, and he was in they used to have a race called the Sierra Nevada. It was the Charles Strube Stakes, but on the turf. It was a four-year-old only race going 1.25 miles on the turf, and it was a grade three. So Shoemaker had ridden him in the prep race, and it was unfortunate, but Lee Rossi had a horse in the race, and Lee's horse bit Pewter Gray on the ass going into the first turn, and he took off with Shoemaker. And Shoe came back, and he said, Jude, we ran second that day, he said, Jude, I don't know what happened. He said, but this horse, all of a sudden, he like took off on me on the turn, and I started to laugh. And he goes, what's so funny? I said, Billy got bit in the ass. And he goes, no. And I go, yeah, he did. I said, go watch the replay. And Lee's horse bit him in the butt, and he took off. Obviously, that's what you do, right? I mean, if somebody bit you in the ass, you'd kind of like scoot away.
Right, sure.
And anyway, so he ran second that day. So Whittingham put a horse in the Sierra Nevada, so Shoe had to ride him. And I was lucky enough to get Eddie Delahousie, and Eddie had won a bunch of races for me up to that time. And so Eddie broke out of the gate, went to the lead, never looked back, and I won my first grade three. It was a $100,000 grade three. It was a fantastic day. It vindicated me and my brother. And I mean, it was just one of the best feelings you could ever have, really. It was phenomenal.
Do you remember how you celebrated that night?
No, I do remember Chuck Marikian, who used to train horses. He literally picked me up off the ground. Now that's no easy feat, but Chuck was, I believe, a offensive lineman for Fresno State. So he was a big fella too, but he literally picked me up off the ground when the horse crossed the wire. And then it was great because then Chuck won the Stroop Stakes the next day. So our barn, we were stabled next to one another, and our barn was super hot that weekend. We had all the reporters over there. So it was a lot of fun. And then later on, somebody said to Charlie Whittingham, oh, wasn't that great? Jude won his first graded race. And Charlie says, you got to squash the ants before they eat the whole picnic.
In typical Whittingham fashion.
That's right.
Well, if you don't think this is a difficult game, just think about waiting 8 years for your next graded stakes winner, because that's what you had to do. That was 83 when you won the Grade 3 Sierra Nevada. You had to wait till 1991 for your next one. It was the Grade 2 Chula Vista Handicap with a French bet horse by the name of Ville Vin. Tell me about that one.
Well, Ville Vin was a horse that was owned by Dick Gayson and Ian Fry and Carol Masters. And, you know, she was a terrific filly. But what I remember, first of all, about her was her first race in the United States. These guys were really high on Ville Vin, and they really thought she could do well in the United States. And I've got her in on the turf, and it starts pouring down rain the night before, and I'm fit to be tied. I'm like so close to tears. I can't believe it. I've got this filly so good, and she's ready to run, and now it's pouring down rain. And so the next morning I put in a scratch card because I know they're not going to go for running her in the mud, and I don't really like to run horses in the mud anyway. But so I put in a scratch card. Well, like everybody scratched. I think there were two horses that were going to run, and I get a call from Tommy Robbins, and he said, look, you know, everybody scratched out of this race. Is there any chance you'd stay in? And I go, Tommy, this horse came from Europe and blah, blah, blah. And I said, I got to come out. And he said, well, will you stay in for a while? And I said, what does that mean? And he goes, will you stay in till like an hour before the race and then decide? And I go, well, okay, but I'm going to scratch. He goes, that's okay. But he says, I can't run a match race here. Can you just stay in? And I said, okay, I'll stay in. So I stayed in, and Dick Gayson came out to watch the filly run. And I'm watching the races, and I'm going, God, you know, speed isn't sticking at all. And I know my filly can finish. And I've got Lafitte, the greatest mud rider in the history of the world, Lafitte Pink Eye Jr. And so why should we scratch? Why don't we just run and win? And the purse was a lot of money I for those days. I don't know, it might have even been like 60 grand or something. I don't know. It was a pretty nice allowance race.
Yeah.
So I talked Dick into running. I said, you know, I don't usually like to run, but I said, this filly can't lose this race. The horses that were left were nondescript, and I mean, I knew how good she was, and having Lafitte was really the icing on the cake. So Dick called England, and they had a powwow, and they said, all right, go ahead and run if you want to run. Well, she won for fun. She won by like 6 lengths and proceeded to make $500,000 on the dirt. So it was the best thing that ever happened, and it looked the night before like it was the worst thing that ever happened to me. So you never know how it's all going to work out, but That kind of launched her career on the dirt. And then, you know, she won the Biaceo Stakes at Del Mar twice. She won the Chula Vista. She ran in the Chula Vista three times. She won it the first year. The second year, she chipped her knee and finished fifth. Then I decided I wanted to bring her back and have her win it one last time. And she got a ridiculous weight. They give her 111 pounds. And Tommy Robbins said it was the first time a trainer ever yelled at him for giving them too light of a weight. But I couldn't get a jockey to do the weight. You know, there was nobody available that could do the weight. So Sal Gonzalez rode her for me. He was an apprentice, or he might have been an apprentice at the time, or just lost his bug, and he could do the weight. And Sal rode a great race, and we got beat a zop. We finished second, and but I really always thought, you know, if I could have had Delahousie or Stevens or something, that, you know, that we maybe could have won the race. But I can't knock Sal's ride. I mean, he did a phenomenal job. And so, you know, she had a good record in the Chula Vista. Like I said, she won the Biaco at Del Mar twice. Del Mar actually had a race named after her for a long, long time. It's since gone by the wayside. But, you know, she was the queen of Del Mar. People still, to this very day, people come up and talk to me about Ville Vin, and I had shot my mouth off in the form on the Wednesday before the race, saying that she wasn't going to lose. And she ran against Brought to Mind and Light Light, who were the two best fillies in the country. Light Light was MC Hammer's filly, and she was a freak. And so, you know, it was a big, big win for me, and thank God it backed up what I said in the form. Otherwise, I would have looked like a gigantic idiot. But,
yeah, well, you know, and you didn't have to wait 8 years for your third one either, because that came just 2 years later in 93.
It did?
Your third greatest stakes win.
Yeah.
Keep up.
What's that?
Keep up.
Okay, well, when you said 8 years ago, was it really that long between drinks?
Yeah, between the grade three Sierra Nevada and the Chula Vista it was, but then,
yeah,
of course, 2 years later.
I mean, that's crazy because, you know, like I say, I kind of lose track of time. I'm not very good with time, But, yeah, you're talking about Steffi Graf and the Golden Poppy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That was like one of the best days of my life. There were so many things that were crazy about that day, but that was just awesome. Kenny Skinner rode that filly for me, and she was coming off an 8 month layoff, and she was a speed filly from Brazil. She's a very, very good filly, one of the most talented horses I ever trained, and speed was not sticking that day. Matter of fact, speed was dying and I was like cleaning up at the windows. I was there with, Susan Zimber's niece, Dick Gason's longtime partner. Susan's niece picked me up at the airport and we went to the races together and we were creaming them. We had like $3,000 sitting in the middle of the table at one time during the day.
Wow.
Just betting, you know, a few exactas here and there, whatever. And so I made a big bet on this filly, and I absolutely loved her. She could not have been training any better. And I get to the paddock, and Skinner says to me, "Speed's not sticking." And I said, "Listen to me. You go to the front and just keep going. Don't even think about rating, taking this filly back. Just go to the front." And he goes, "Jude, speed's dying." I said, "Please, just do what I say. You'll be very happy." And she went wire to wire, and she paid another ridiculous price, $43 or some crazy ass thing. I left the track with almost $8,000 in my pocket, and it was nuts. I mean, we just had the best day. So Skinner and I get to the airport. We get on our plane. This is long before 9/11, obviously. And I tell the stewardess, I said, "All the drinks are on us on the flight home." I said, "Whatever anybody wants, the drinks are on us. You just give me the bill at the end of the flight." And she goes, "Really? Are you sure?" And I said, "Yeah, fine." You know what happens? 40 nuns get on the plane. They were at a convention in San Francisco, and
oh, wow.
40 nuns get on the plane. So our bar tab went noticeably down, although a couple of nuns had beer and some wine and whatever, but the bar tab was less than $200 for the whole plane. So on top of having a great day, we had even a better day because it didn't cost us $1,000 in cocktails on the way home. But it was just one of those days that everything that I did was perfect. Every bet that I made was perfect. It was just, and we get home after buying the drinks on the plane, and Susan and Dick are in the airport with bottles of champagne and confetti and streamers waiting for Kenny and I to get off the plane. So all the people on the plane, they're going, "Who are these two bozos? We have no idea who they are." You know, and here comes confetti and streamers, and we're pouring champagne for people. It was crazy. I mean, it was so unbelievable. It was a great day.
That's a great story. And when you're hot, you're hot. Jude Feld here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. JT, one other thing I know that you like to talk about quite often, because it's kind of special, are some of the celebrities that you had the opportunity to train for. Tim Conway, Vic Tayback, and even Kevin Costner was a client of yours for a while. Tell me about that. That had to be kind of cool.
Yeah, it's always fun, you know, when celebrities have horses, and it's great for the game. And those guys are all good guys. They were all very different guys. Tim loves the sport. He tried to be a jockey at one time. He's loved horse racing his whole life. Him and his wife, Charlene, were very good clients He offered Charlene a big engagement ring or a horse. She took the horse, and I got to train that filly, Miss Bossy Knickers. Bossy Knickers was her name. She won first time out at Santa Anita, and Charlene never got to see her run because she hated to watch races. They made her nervous, so she faced the wall in the turf club, and then Tim had to bring her down the winner's circle. But, yeah, very, very good time with the Conways and Harvey Corman and Joe Hamilton, who was married to Carol Burnett, and Ernie Anderson, who's the guy that said, the love boat. those guys all owned the horse in partnership, which was a total hoot. They had no passing on the back of their silk. They thought that was going to get them a win. But their horse was kind of slow, so it didn't matter. Vic Tabak, classy guy, one of the best guys in the world, just really took care of people and loved the sport, went to the races almost every day when he wasn't working. Good family guy, just loved Vic. He's amazing. And Kevin, Kevin's a huge star. And when he would come to the races, people would always flock around the box and stuff. He was always very gracious and he would always talk to people and, wish them good luck on their day. And he's a wonderful guy. And I love spending time with him, if I have the chance. So, it's a lot of fun. It's great for the game to have those people involved. And especially when they're nice people and are friendly with the fans and all of that, it's really special.
You finally stepped away from training horses in 2000. What was it that led to your decision to step away?
Well, there were lots of things. I had some things going on in my personal life. I was getting a divorce and things had changed. I lost one of my biggest clients. And so I just decided it was time to do something else. I had told myself that if I ever, got up in the morning, didn't feel like going to the barn, that I would quit. And that's kind of where it got. I only had a couple of horses, which I owned pieces of myself that weren't very fast. And I sent them north to a friend of mine and just said, that's it. I'm going to do something else. And, luckily, I got offered a job at Keeneland, which was just a seasonal job, but it turned into a year-round job. And I worked for Keeneland for 10 years. So that was good. And through that, I met you and do the horse races on the radio now. And, I still dabble here and there. I do a lot of consulting work. Michael House, one of my longtime clients, I help him with his horses. And people call me every once in a while for pedigree advice or to go to a sale and look for a horse for them. So I still dabble in it a little bit, but not as intensely as I used to.
Do you ever find yourself missing training horses full time?
People ask me that all the time, and I really don't. I mean, I don't miss Fridays when it's payroll day and you've got to write checks for $7,000 and you only have $3,000 in the bank. I don't miss that at all. But, I miss being around the horses more than anything. But I've been able to tailor make my life through running farms in Kentucky and things like that, where I actually get to spend time around horses. And so it's not so much the racing and the competition that I miss. It's the animals themselves. So I try to go out, as much as I can to the backside. I love when the horses come into the paddock. I've been like that since I was a little kid. I mean, I used to spend most of my time at Santa Anita in the paddock. I was much more interested in looking at the horses. I would keep records of who wore bandages, what kind of equipment the horses had on and all that. I was always more into the animals than anything. And so I just try to keep that up as much as possible. Whenever I have a chance to be around horses, I take it.
3 years after you retired from training, you were working at Keeneland, as you mentioned. It was in 2003, and you were honored with the first of two Eclipse Awards that you've won in your post-training career. This one I thought was very interesting, though, because you wrote this piece as a collaboration with G.D. Hieronymus at Keeneland. And the title of the piece was, If It Was Easy, Everyone Would Do It. And it focused on the training aspect of the game, which I thought was so appropriate for you, being a former trainer and having spent so much time around it, devoting your life to that side of the business, to put together a piece that was very much heartfelt and have it win an Eclipse Award. You had to just be blown away.
I was shocked. I think Marty McGee was the first person to send me a note to congratulate me, and I thought he was joking, because it was a small piece. We'd done it for the Bluegrass Dinner. Every year G.D. would do a film for the Bluegrass Dinner, and he asked me if I would write a piece about training horses, and literally, Mike, it took me 20 minutes to write that. It just flowed out of me, I guess, maybe because, you know, I had missed, you know, being in the game and I know how hard it is. I mean, it's like the hardest thing you can do. And I told people when I got in the game, a couple of my dad's friends tried to talk me out of it. And I said, no, because this is really difficult. And I want to see if I can do it, you know, and I won 5 out of my first 7 races, and that was pretty exciting, and then they kind of shut up after that. But, you know, I certainly didn't have a Hall of Fame career, but I think I did a pretty good job with the horses that I had. And, you know, I know how difficult it is. And that piece just flowed out of me. And we did it for the Bluegrass Dinner. And then later on, Dick Gabriel, one of the local newsmen in Lexington, he wanted to put it on his Breeders' Cup show. So I rewrote it to be a little bit more Breeders' Cup centric, and he put it on his television show, and it won the local television award. And I was very honored, very thrilled, you know, for myself, for GD, and for Keeneland. I mean, you know, I wrote some nice words, but GD put beautiful pictures to what I wrote, and it really is a really nice piece. It's on racehorsereport.com if anybody wants to take a look at it. It's also at keeneland.com in their archive.
Hard to believe we've been visiting for just about a full hour now on Trainer Talk. Jude Feld, pontiff of the Pick Four. You can catch him with me on so many of our major broadcasts coming up throughout the year and on so many different talk shows. JT, only about 2 minutes left. Want to let people know that it was 2007 when you first joined the HRN team, and we've been traveling together ever since. It has been such a thrill for me to get to know you, to get to hear these stories, and there are so many more. We could spend another hour very, very easily. One thing that you are, more than anything, is a huge family person. Of course, you and your wife, Gretchen, a perfect fit, but your immediate family with your brothers, Bob and Mark. We started talking about Bob being a bloodstock agent. He's bought, I don't know, a gazillion Breeders' Cup winners. Your brother Mark, he's a horse owner. You're all very, very close. One moment that stands out to me is when we were broadcasting the Breeders' Cup in 2010 and Shared Account won the Filly Amare Turf. And it was so genuine. You got choked up. It was a horse that your brother purchased. And boy, I think about those times and you think, yeah, you have to have a passion for this sport if you're going to be around it.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that was a big moment for our family. Bob buying that filly and watching her win. And, you know, I mean, the days when we used to cut out charts of Charlie Whittingham's horses and just dream that someday we could be in this game. And to have that opportunity to be there to be broadcasting that race, to share in that experience with my brother and Sagamore Farm and my nephew. I mean, it was surreal. It was awesome. And it's just one of those things where, you know, you can't believe it's actually happening. So, you know, I think back to the days when we were so young and pasting charts into spiral bound notebooks. And then here we are at the Breeders' Cup, you know, insane when you think about it.
Jude Feld, pontiff of the Pick Four, here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. JT, couldn't be happier to call you my friend. Really do appreciate it. Look forward to traveling with you again this year, and all the best. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being on the show, and I'm very proud to be part of HRRN.
All right, if you missed any portion of this show, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast, also Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I am Mike Penna. And for Jude Feld, thank you for listening to Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tippins.